Kildare Today
with Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Now, over the last couple of days, we have featured the presidents of the three teacher unions here in the country regarding pupils in primary and secondary schools of all types, regarding how safe or otherwise they are. We've heard about the low numbers of students who attended yesterday, with up to 40% of students in some schools not turning up as parents expressed their concerns via those means. Very interestingly, yesterday, despite all the assurances that the government were given, the Taoiseach and everybody else, and particularly Minister Norma Foley, were giving in recent days and weeks about how safe schools were and that. It was very interesting, and people out there might be cynical, might say, how come this particular report only emerged yesterday, hours after the schools opened? Because the report in question that just emerged yesterday is the latest data from the Health Protection Surveillance Centre looking at the total number of outbreaks recorded in the fourth wave of the virus between June last and the 31st of December. The largest number of outbreaks, 919, were recorded amongst families in private homes. But the next highest figure was associated with school students and staff, with 514 outbreaks among these groups in the last 6 months of the year. Now, if you take it, by the way, that the 919 families who recorded COVID in their homes, you have to accept that some of that could have been brought home from schools. So the 514 outbreaks in schools ranks it amongst the highest aspects of the outbreak of COVID, despite Norma Foley saying that every sector of society is challenged in terms of personnel being in place. But the most important factor, she said, and I quote, that we're opening the schools and we will operate to their maximum capacity from Thursday. Over 200,000 cases of COVID-19 have been recorded since schools closed 2 weeks ago for the Christmas break. We know all about that, but cynics out there will say, how come that report didn't emerge before yesterday? It came after the schools, and it shows the extent of the outbreaks of COVID within schools and what's facing teachers, and in particular those who care for very young children. Well, let's move down the chronological ladder then to those in the preschool, and to tell us how they're faring is the CEO of Early Childhood Ireland, Teresa Heaney, who joins us on the programme. Teresa, good morning to you and Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us on Kildare Today. Now, Teresa, what's your overall reaction to how your sector is doing?
Yeah, so our sector has, some of it opened last week in between the days between Christmas and New Year, but most of the sector is opening this week, and they are keen to open, nervous open, but very, you know, we've been open as a sector since June of 2020. We haven't been shut down since that. But there is no doubt that the impact of the virus on the capacity and the operation of services is very, very significant. I think we can replicate that numbers are down, that, you know, maybe about 25%. It's hard to know, as you can imagine. It's hard to know yet how many children didn't attend yesterday, but maybe about 25% of children didn't attend. And I would have to say, Clem, that that is absolutely matches the numbers of staff who've not been attending either, not been available for work. I would be hearing members of Early Childhood Ireland telling us that maybe some as low as 10% of their staff are not available. It's up as high as 50% in some areas. And indeed, I was talking to a member up in the northwest yesterday, and only two of her staff were available, so she had to close an entire set service. So, you know, depending on the community and maybe how rife COVID is or Omicron is in a particular community, you can see that directly impacting in the early year service, because obviously our staff are drawn from the community as well. So it's a very, very challenging situation. It's very stressful for operators because of the uncertainty. It's very difficult to plan. So every day they're talking to parents, trying to assess what the parent needs, what the parent's going to need tomorrow, what the parent's going to need next week, how supportive maybe the parents' employers are in terms of being able to work from home for some of the days. And then when our members hear and understand from parents what they need, they then are trying to match that to the numbers of staff that are available, and trying then to keep the service open using our pods. Don't forget that we have pods. We can't mix our pods. But we also have to maintain very strict adult-child ratios and space ratios, and we're not allowed to mix the age groups either. So we have all of these other variables going on that the operators of services are trying to think about. So it is a very, very challenging environment for the members of Early Childhood Ireland that are operating today, that are open today.
And if I might paraphrase the poet John Donne, no sector of Irish society is an island unto itself, and the ripple effects that happens in any sector of Irish society impacts on all sectors. If the schools are in trouble and close down, this is sending kids home. Parents have to go to work.
Yeah.
If creches are not open for parents, what are parents going to do, etc., etc., Teresa?
Yeah, it's very challenging. And, you know, I think that what I was hearing from our members in Early Childhood Ireland is that parents have been very helpful. They're very understanding. They're very happy to, so some of the solutions that the services have been introducing is they've reduced down their opening hours. So because they may not have enough staff to stay open, for example, from 7:30 to 6:30. So maybe what they're doing instead is they can manage to keep a service open by operating from maybe 8:30 to 5:00, and they don't need a change of staff. You know, they only need one shift of staff to do that. So that's one of the things that I can see is happening all around the place. Mm. The other thing is they're offering, they're able to maybe, some parents maybe can say, look, we can manage on Thursday and Friday, but we really need help on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So they're trying to match parents like that, trying to match availability with the parents' needs in that way.
Now, in regards to needs, Teresa, I understand you met the Minister for Children and the HSE recently, and like the primary and secondary school sector, you're looking for clarification on isolation guidance, because different versions of that, who should isolate, when should they isolate, when is it safe to come back? And remember, you're dealing with the youngest cohort of all, very, very young children, and also the lack of resources like PCR and antigen testing for your members as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've been asking the Minister for a few things. We've been saying we really need to make sure that parents understand that the children shouldn't attend if they have any symptoms or if they've been in contact. The isolation guide is very challenging to understand. I mean, I think everybody would say that, you know, if you're boosted and you're 2 days and if you're antigen and positive, and it's very, very challenging. But so, you know, a one clear isolation guide would be really helpful. But it seems that isolation guide isn't going to change following the NPHET meeting yesterday. So we're still trying to work with the current guide that's out there. Antigen testing gives confidence to our staff, the staff in the member services, but they're becoming very hard to access. So we're asking, you know, is there a source that we can go to where we can get easy access to antigen testing? And of course, the delay in PCR testing is very, very challenging, and it would be brilliant if that were accelerated as well for our members, because if somebody is negative, then obviously they're able to return to work.
Yeah, and finally, so, Teresa, nobody should underestimate for a moment the importance of your sector, because hundreds of thousands of parents, working parents around this country, are dependent on your sector, because if their local creche is not available, it's a case of how do I get the children minded? Am I going to have to give up some of my earnings? Is it going to compromise my workplace?
I mean, it's an incredibly important and essential service for parents and families. The other thing I would just add, I mean, I would absolutely agree with the point that you're making, Clem. I would also add that we have to remember that it's an essential service for children as well. Children come, I mean, I was talking to members of Early Childhood Ireland yesterday who said they were so pleased to be able to open their service because children were just so excited to get back into what, you know, an ordinary playful environment where they can play and touch and hug their friends and nobody's policing their ordinary play activities. So we have to put value on that as well. the experience of children on a day-to-day basis. And there's a lot of children with additional needs that attend our services, and they need to be attending as well on a day-to-day basis. So it's essential, certainly, for families and communities, but it is absolutely an essential place for our children to be attending on a day-to-day basis.
And that very self-evident fact, CEO of Early Childhood Ireland, Teresa Heaney, thanks for sharing your thoughts, and we wish you and indeed your colleagues in the sector very well, because your well-being, we're all very much dependent on that. Teresa, good morning to you. Happy New Year, and thanks for joining us this morning. Thank you indeed. Owen, you have news of Bord na Mona and Prosperous Bog.
Yeah, it's something that we've covered on the programme previously, and I think it was down around the Monastrevan area when we touched on this before. But yeah, as you say, it's happening now in Prosperous Bog. Bord na Mona are proposing to carry out rehabilitation measures on the bog. And there's a public consultation open until the 2nd of February. Social Democrats councillor on the Claimanuth Municipal District, Aidan Farley, joins me now. Aidan, good morning.
Morning, Owen.
Tell me a little bit about it then. What are the plans from Bord na Mona?
Indeed, so we received communications from Bord na Mona this week that they proposed to carry out rehabilitation measures on Prosperous Bog, which is a site just to the northwest of the village, and it's about 220 hectares wide. And so the first step in these rehabilitation measures is to finalise the rehabilitation plan for the bog. And essentially the key outcome here is that we want to see environmental stabilisation and for that site to be re-wetted. So Bord na Mona would describe this as a plan to essentially put a skin back on the peat that is there on the land. And so to re-wet that bog, essentially we have to block the drains because there's a natural gravity drainage system on that site. So Bord na Mona proposed to block those drains and re-wet that site. But why I kind of put it up in the social media to draw public's attention to it, essentially there's a public consultation open now for approximately 4 weeks. And that's the opportunity. I've spoken to a lot of people around Prosperous who are already starting to see, as that site is decommissioned, are already starting to see natural habitats and activity start to generate themselves on that site. So it's an opportunity for people to put their ideas to Bord na Mona, to kind of think about different seeds, to think about different habitats that might be there, and to put those ideas forward.
Just remind us of where exactly the Prosperous Bog is, Aidan. Would I be right in saying it's located beside Ballinafail Lake?
Indeed, correct. That's exactly it. So if you're in Prosperous and you're heading out towards Dunedee, you head straight out and it's on your right, and it's kind of just head northwest towards Dunedee from Prosperous, and it's that whole kind of site there. And there's Bord na Mona signs on that, so people will be very aware from kind of travelling to Dunedee and different sites from Prosperous of where that site is. And so the plan is to have this stabilisation plan or the rehabilitation plan finalised in the next couple of months, and for works to begin quite quickly on this. Bord na Mona are confident that within 5 to 10 years you'll start to see real change, and the climate action benefits really are significant for something like this. But it's rare that we as the public have opportunities to really influence these plans, and this is one of those times where for Prosperous certainly we would encourage people to kind of send in the emails, or even if they want to contact me, I can put the submissions in on their behalf if they don't have access to emails.
Okay, a draft rehabilitation plan and the associated map book for the bog as well is available on the Bord na Mona website, and you can get more details on your social media, Aidan. But what other ways, very quickly, can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, so they can give me a call if you want to give out my phone number, that's no problem at all. Or they can send me an email at afarley@kildareco.ie. But the email directly to Bord na Mona is pcasinfo@bnm.ie. But again, that's all up on my social medias, on Twitter and Facebook, Owen, so people can find out more information there.
Okay, Social Democrats councillor on the Claimanuth Municipal District, Aidan Farley, good morning.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, just one text before we go to our next guest. Steve, thanks for the email. Steve is in Nace. He loves the show. Thank you for that. But says that my attitude towards the tennis situation in poor is poor. Australia has become a communist-like country along with Austria and Germany. Vaccination mandates. No man, woman or child should be forced through rules and fines to get vaccinated. It's a basic human right to have the right of choice. The media is bringing no balance to this and money is driving it. Would you please bring balance to your programme, for example, Dr. Vincent Carroll, who's a different angle in all of this, and Steve in this. 2 points I'd like to make, Steve. In the past, we have endeavoured to get anti-vax people on this programme without any success, to just give their point of view, the balance that you're talking about. In regards to the situation in Australia with Novak Djokovic, nobody is forcing Novak Djokovic to get vaccinated. The scenario is that the country, like many other countries around the world, in the interest of public health, has set rules regarding if you're vaccinated, you can do this. If you're not vaccinated, you can't do this. Just in the same way that I've said before, if you have a driving license, you can drive a car. If you don't have a driving license, you can't. And that's not discrimination. It's just a simple fact of the way we do things. So in the case of Novak Djokovic, he was asked to provide documentation to prove why he should have a medical exemption. Apparently, as I understand it, that documentation is not coming. So why should there be any grandstanding by the number one tennis player in the world to be treated any differently to any other person arriving in Australia or in any other country? That's what it's about. And you know, remarks by his father that Novak is Jesus of our times is so ridiculous as to just not even merit comment. But I appreciate your point and thanks for getting in touch, Steve. Now, speaking, by the way, about what might be going on in a country or whatever else, our attention was drawn lately to the fact that just one in four people brought to court for driving while using their mobile phones are being convicted. Now, again, we can go back and make this whole ridiculous situation. Should you be allowed to use your mobile phone? Should you be allowed to drive without a driving license? Should you be allowed to drive without insurance because it's your civil right to do whatever? You know, you can bring that debate on and on and on. New data shows that between 2018 and 2020, more than 15,000 cases were brought before our courts for driving with a mobile phone. But the conviction rate ranges from 14% in County Sligo to 36% in County Wicklow. And outside of the four major cities, in Kildare, 835 people were brought before three courts over the three-year period. But the county had only a 19% conviction rate. What's going on, we ask? Susan Gray is founder of Park Road Safety Group. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, sir.
You must be aghast at these statistics, are you?
Yeah, we had hoped that following the stats we did in 2017, that the conviction rate would have got higher in 2018 to 2020. Deputy Catherine Murphy raised these questions for us in the Doyle and PQs, parliamentary questions, and we noticed that the situation's getting worse. 2015 to 2017, when Tommy Bruin raised the questions for us, there was a 36% conviction rate. Now, when Catherine Murphy raised it recently for us to cover 2018 to 2020, there was only a 25% conviction rate. So that's 75% walking out of the courts without a conviction, without the five penalty points that they would have got if they were convicted. Penalty points are a great deterrent, as we all know. Mm. And it should be deterring people going to courts. If you're caught on a mobile phone and you pay the FCM, you get three penalty points. But if you fail to pay it and go to court, the penalty is five penalty points and an increased fine.
Do I understand, Susan, correctly? Did I hear somewhere that while Kildare's conviction rate from 835 people being brought before the courts over the three-year period, there was only a 19% conviction rate? That's just a fifth of those convicted. Were there no convictions at all in one particular year?
Well, Kildare, in 2018, we broke it down per year. So in 2018, there was 285 before the courts, and 94 was convicted. That's 33%. We went on to 2019. There was 383, 18% conviction rate. But we noticed in 2020, the figures that the Minister for Transport gave us said, the amended figures said that 167 was before the courts, but none of them was convicted.
Of 160 in 2020, 167 Gardaí summons people for using their mobile phone in County Kildare 167 times, and not one of them are convicted. What's going on, Susan?
I don't know. Now, we're doing the stats on another fixed charge penalty point notice, and we're seeing the same. There's something happened in Kildare in 2020, and we would love if somebody would look into it, because we follow the guards on Facebook and Twitter, and we're always commending these roads tracing units. They're way up there at the top for detecting lawbreakers. They're always posted on Facebook and Twitter, and we usually commend them on it.
Yeah, and when I first
saw, we've got a massive shock here. We've been doing statistics now since about 2013, 2014, and Kildare and Wexford, usually with most of our figures, when we delve down and do the breakdown, they usually come out tops. So we got a massive shock, and especially when you see them out there enforcing the law so vigorously. I don't know, but I would say it's a multitude of reasons, but somebody would need to look into it.
So just give me that 2020 stat again. How many people were brought before the courts in Kildare?
They say 167 were listed.
And not a single conviction. No. Very strange as to the reasons. I know that the reason some people advance in court is that they didn't get the letter. We have this scenario that it's to do, that one of the reasons being advanced, as I understand it, is that in the old days there was an on-the-spot fine. But now Gardaí, when they stop you for that, inform you that you could be prosecuted. They then go back to the station and process on their computers. This is the way the system. And is that enabling people to come into court and say, well, I got no letter, I got no notification?
There's no excuse for not present conviction.
But it's happening.
No matter what
it's what's
scenario
happening, isn't
you
it?
Bring up, the law of averages is some. And the new stats we're doing now, breakdown from another PQ that Catherine Murphy raised for us, it's coming up the same in 2020 for Kildare, and you'll be seeing it soon coming out when we finalise it. But like, we have too a huge problem. What we do when we get the raw data from the court service, we break it down into counties, and then we do a further breakdown into each district court in that county to try to get to the source of where the worst problems lie. And when you see Mayo, 8% conviction rate in 2018.
And Mayo,
overall,
Mayo has often been touted as one of the safest, you know, the best road safety programs in the country. I can, you know, I said when I saw this data that Gardaí must be tearing their hair out. You know, they witness people holding mobile phones. They just, and by the way, you're right about the Naas policing unit in particular, because I see them every single night on Twitter putting up cases in regards to that. So a Gardaí sees someone using a mobile phone, issues a warning to that person that they will be facing prosecution, goes back, puts that into the computer system, and then, without the availability of hard paperwork, or if there had been an on-the-spot fine and the matter is dealt with, apparently some of those charged are going into court saying, I didn't get the documentation. It never arrived in the post, and the judge has no choice but to observe that. We were in touch with Catherine Murphy, by the way, who's on leave at the moment, and we're going to follow this further, Susan, with Catherine in the next couple of days. We'll have Catherine on again to see about follow-up on this, okay?
Yes, because the figures we got for 2015 to 2017 through Tommy Bruin before he retired, it showed Kildare 51% conviction rate.
Right. And now it's down to 19%, and in 2020, none at all. Okay, we're going to follow this topic with Catherine Murphy when she returns off leave. We chatted to her in the last couple of days about this. But meanwhile, Susan Gray, founder of the Park Road Safety Group. Thanks indeed, Susan.
Thank you. Okay, thanks.
And good morning. Happy New Year to you. Now, it's remarkable, isn't it? Can you imagine? And, you know, all these statistics will just encourage other people to chance their arm. So when they were on the spot fines, you were nailed. You know, once the Garda wrote out the summons, gave it to you, and this, that, and the other. But as I understand it now, the Garda doesn't write out anything that he or she hands to you anymore. They just advise you that you could be prosecuted or will be prosecuted. And after that, it goes into the electronic system. And therefore, I don't know. We'll find out more about this in the next couple of days, but it's astonishing that in a whole year, 135 people in 2020 brought before the courts, not a single one of them was convicted. It does undermine safety organisations' drive to keep our roads safer in regards to that. Right, today is an historic day. 100 years ago this day, the treaty which partitioned Ireland was signed. Local historian James Durney of the Kildare Library Service and Decade of Commemorations Committee, and author of many, many books on local history in Kildare, including the whole 1916 War of Independence and Civil War period, joins us. Good morning, James.
Morning, Clem.
Thank you for joining us. An understatement, to say the least, one of the most key dates in our history.
Definitely one of the most key dates, and one of the most controversial, I suppose, since that period, the signing and ratification of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, which, of course, took place 100 years ago today.
Now, it did take place on this day, but James, negotiations had been going on in London since the previous early December, the 5th of December, in fact, where the Irish delegation had taken up two residences. And the Irish delegation was not just the seven who were inside the negotiations. There was a huge backup staff as well.
Of course, yeah, there was until only recently, the women who had played a great part of the secretaries and that too, the plenipotentiaries, as they were known as at the time, have been really remained unknown. And it's only in the last couple of months that historians have really found out who these were. But as you say, these debates or negotiations had been going on from October, really,
yeah,
in 1921, which culminated in the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty on the 6th of December. But then when they come back to Ireland, then immediately there's dissent, and of course then the Dáil Éireann has to meet to debate the
Now, there was huge dissent even within the delegation itself, and one of the key things was that while Michael Collins led the delegation to England, Eamon de Valera, who in fact was president of the so-called Republic at that stage, did not go. And there's been much speculation over the centuries as to why he did not go, with some advancing that he was playing a very, very shrewd game in letting the others go, and he wouldn't be tarred negatively with any negative outcome.
Yeah, because, you know, you can say that he possibly knew that they would never get a republic. A republic was never on the cards for the British. Lloyd George was never, Chamberlain, Churchill, they were never going to agree to a republic right beside the, you know, England, Scotland and Wales. So that was off the cards. The Northern Ireland had already been formed as a new parliament. Partition had began in June 1921. And partition doesn't really come up in the treaty debate in Dublin in December and January of 1921.
That Government of Ireland Act, which established 1920, the Northern Ireland Parliament. But while these delegates who went from Dublin to negotiate the treaty were described as plenipotentiaries, which meant they would have full power to make their decisions, the contradiction in that is that they were also instructed to revert back to Dublin before they signed anything, which they did not do, and gave De Valera and those opposed to the signing an excuse to try to block it.
Yeah, they should have, like, in all reality, they should have reported back. But don't forget, like, in that time, I mean, there was no mobile phones or nothing like that. We couldn't just phone back to Dublin, and it was travelling back and forth on the rail lines and then the mail boat back to Dublin to report on that. So it wasn't an easy thing just to report back to Dublin and get word back to De Valera and the others and that. But again, of course, they shouldn't have signed. But we know now that they possibly signed under duress, like it was war or peace was what was laid down to them. And it was probably a bluff by Lloyd George at the time, because they didn't want to go back to war either, because the British Empire was under so much pressure.
And there was also the point that you made there earlier, that people like Lord Birkenhead and Winston Churchill, Birkenhead in particular, was an avowed unionist, and he wasn't going to undermine the unionist case in Northern Ireland for a separate state. But one of the other reasons that was advanced by the Irish delegation was they had been given to understand that a border commission or a boundary commission would be set up, which ultimately would give two of the six counties, Fermanagh and Tyrone, to the new Irish Free State, as it was going to be called, not a republic, and that therefore in time the remaining four counties would be economically unviable and would agree to join. But that never, of course, unfolded, James.
No, that's the thing. Like, I mean, as you say, the Boundary Commission was meant to give a majority of Catholic majority counties in Northern Ireland would vote to go back into the new Irish state, and that never would have happened anyway. But the Boundary Commission, of course, Craig never really had any faith in that, and he didn't want it to work anyway, so he wasn't going to cooperate on that anyway. But there was other plans too as well. I'm sure Michael Collins had military plans to trying to force Northern Ireland into an Irish state, not militarily, but they would have launched attacks along the border and that in the future. And this was one of the reasons he was trying to keep the IRA together in the event that the treaty was passed.
Well, we know what happened. It came back to a Doyle vote, which was 64-57, and we know what happened within a very, very short time. De Valera walked out of the situation at that stage as totally anti-treaty, and the real tragedy that unfolded, and you've covered this, James, extensively in by book as well, was the Civil War then unfolded, which, as I've said, there was as much savagery and probably more unleashed as there had been in the War of Independence. But just one final point before you go, James, because time is against us. How was the whole treaty debate reflected here in County Kildare?
Well, the two Kildare TDs, Art O'Connor and Donal O'Buchla, voted against the treaty. And the majority of people, like the newspapers, the Nationalist, the Leinster Leader, the Kildare Observer, they were all for the treaty. The Catholic Church was for the treaty. All the local authorities were for the treaty. And, you know, the majority of people were for the treaty. But our two TDs voted against it, and Art O'Connor went on to fight in Dublin during the fighting in Dublin in July 1922, and was arrested there along with Cathal Brewer just before Cathal Brewer was killed.
And was that the attack on the forecourts? The anti-treaty group took over the forecourts, was it? And
yeah, Art O'Connor was in the Hammond Hotel with Cathal Brewer, which was the block, the Dublin block in O'Connell Street, which was after the forecourts, was the fighting, which occurred after the fall of the forecourts in the centre of Dublin, and Dublin again was wrecked by artillery and the fighting there as well. So that's where Art O'Connor and De Valera were, but De Valera escaped, dressed up by, we assume again, as a priest or a woman, depends what stories you believe.
Okay, we'll talk to you indeed hugely over the next couple of months, because the commemoration of the Civil War has to be done as well.